This is Nancy Roth, co-producer of The Bookshelf. Tonight we start a new book. It's How to Be a Sister, a love story with a touch of autism by Eileen Garvin. The book might not have come to my attention so soon, except that the author has a local fan club headed by her mother, Pat Garvin, a great friend of the station. But that's quite peripheral to our choice of this book for The Bookshelf. How to Be a Sister is well-written, thoughtful, and brave, and often quite funny. And the topic is one that has only recently begun to be explored. It's a valuable addition to the literature on autism spectrum disorder, and more broadly, a gentle lesson in dealing with the more challenging relationships in all our lives, whatever their origin.
How to Be a Sister, a Love Story with a Twist of Autism. Chapter 1. Family-Style Dining. Children should be taught to speak quietly and to use their best manners so that this experience is as pleasurable for other restaurant patrons as it is for your family. On Dining Out, Emily posts etiquette. Throughout the course of my life, I've only been certain of two things. I'm the youngest of five children, and I am my sister Margaret's older sister. Even though she was born 3 years earlier than I was the caretaker, the dependable one, and as far as I could see, always will be. Instead of growing up in the protective shadow of my big sister, I often found myself dodging things she was throwing at me or chasing that shadow through a crowd of people as my big sister took off on some crazy escapade. Margaret and I did not choose this role reversal. You could say that her autism assigned it to us. For as long as I can remember, I was often in charge of Margaret, who could never be left alone, and so it fell to me to be the responsible party during the frequent social calamities caused by her trespasses during our childhood, her mirthful and public nudity that I struggled to cover, her loud and clear laughter during moments of silence that I tried to hush, or, worse yet, the times that her anxiety and fear turned into uncontrollable screaming that I was powerless to quell. The passage of time didn't seem to help, and I felt that sense of powerlessness return to me in our adult years. I felt its icy grip one particular June morning as I sat behind the wheel of my mother's car out in front of my sister's house in Spokane, Washington. My mother had lent me the car so that I could take Margaret out to lunch. Lunch. A lunch date. My sister and I are going out to lunch. I'm in town visiting and we're going to grab some lunch. Catch up. In the vocabulary of regular people, this sounded so reasonable, so normal. But where I came from, this was unknown territory that could sooner resemble a riot than two women in their 30s enjoying a midday meal together. I sat in the car, clutching the wheel, trying to gather my thoughts. I simply didn't know what to expect. I'd been in town for several days and was just now getting over to see Margaret. Even though I'd come home expressly to meet with her, I had no idea how this get-together would go and if it would make one or both of us miserable, so I hadn't exactly rushed over to see her. I didn't even know if my big sister would get in the car with me, to be perfectly frank, because she is a woman who loves her routine, and this was definitely something new, having me show up at her house in our mother's car and asking her to go somewhere with me alone. During the past few years, my visits home had grown brief and violent. Violent? Now that's a word you don't like to hear in relation to family togetherness, but it's the only word that begins to tell the truth. When we gathered at our lakeside cabin, my sister would become, at some point in the weekend, out of control. She'd scream, bang the table with her fists, and throw things. She might be set off by some minor disruption, a lost CD, a missing trinket, some undetectable change in the environment. Trying to help my sister in her panic always felt like coming to the aid of a person whose language I didn't speak. She simply cannot put into words the terrible crisis she is in, and I have no way to decipher her need, no matter how dire. After a while, I began to suspect that she wasn't freaking out about any lost item. I started to think she was freaking out because she left the safe and careful routine of her group home to be with the rest of us. She was seeing all of us, who had been absent for most of the year, quite suddenly, in the same place. It was crowded, noisy, and chaotic, and it pissed her off and stressed her out. That was my theory. Whatever the case, Margaret would get upset, then my father would blow his top, and my mother would let him. Then the rest of us would feel responsible and angry and helpless. The world exploded, and no one ever talked about it. Then all that pain and sadness had nowhere to go. I would climb back on the plane to my home in New Mexico with a headache that lasted for days. I would think about my sister and wonder if it would be better not to see her at all. I would think about the rest of my family and wonder how we could survive this decades-old cycle of destruction. As I sat outside Margaret's house in my mother's car, I knew what might happen even if I didn't know what to expect. The possibilities ran rampant in my mind. Dining out with my sister had always been an exceptionally dynamic experience. To begin with, when we were children, eating out was a rare occasion. My parents were always trying to save a buck so they could put us all through Catholic high school and then college, thereby getting us the hell out of the house. Our infrequent dining out was motivated by mental health issues, too. Namely, that taking their five children out in public made my parents want to kill themselves just a little less than they wanted to murder the rest of us. And to make the understatement of the millennium, I'll say that my sister wasn't at her best in restaurants. Noisy, crowded, unfamiliar places stressed her out. Restaurant dining took her out of her rigid, comforting routine and also away from the short menu of foods she found palatable: spaghetti, macaroni and cheese, and spaghetti. There was also the matter of interminable waiting at restaurants, waiting to be seated, waiting for menus, waiting to order. Then she had to wait for the food to come, wait for everyone else to finish eating, wait for the check. This entire process was supremely different from Margaret's preferred mode of dining, what we call the 6.5-minute meal. 390 seconds is all the time it takes for Margaret to charge the table, fill and empty her plate, chug her drink, scramble into her coat while she is still swallowing, and stand by the front door waiting to be driven home. "Thanks for the spaghetti, Mom," she says in her high, monotone voice, waving goodbye to the rest of us who are still sitting at the table with our forks in the air. Leisurely dining was never a habit for Margaret, and during our childhood, the anxiety she felt in a public dining room was more than palpable to the rest of us. It created a force field of nervous energy that electrified everybody as we waited for, well, everything to fall apart. With Margaret, not only did these events become greatly accelerated, but sometimes the distinct periods were jumbled out of order. My sister might order dessert in the lobby when the hostess came to tell us our table was almost ready, or after clamoring over and over again that she wanted spaghetti, please, she'd refuse to speak to the waiter who finally came to take our order. And she couldn't tolerate the time lapse between the ordering part and eating part of dining in a restaurant. It's not that she was particularly ravenous either, as she fretted, waiting for the food to appear. She just wanted to get on with things. Her autism didn't let her appreciate the white space, the pause, the invisible transitions between action and rest in everyday activity. So if she wasn't ordering, by God, she should be eating. And if she was done eating, it was time to go home. As a result, every moment of such an evening, from the second we climbed into our 12-passenger Chevy van and clicked our seatbelts until we were safely back at the house, was well-seasoned with family-wide anxiety. The rest of us might have wanted to enjoy everything, or anything, that happened in between, but for Margaret, the best part of the evening was getting back to the house. The rest of it, on Margaret's terms, was simply a period to be suffered through, and so we all suffered together, as families do. My other siblings and I pondered the ominous, eternal question, when will she lose it? We never thought why or if. We knew from experience that the question was when, so we ate fast. We ate to a silent but thunderous cadence. Can we get through this before Margaret throws a fork and Dad makes us leave? Margaret often came unglued right in the middle of dinner, and it was usually my mother who would extract her from the table. I've often thought this is why my mother never got fat like other moms. She often didn't get to finish her dinner. She certainly never made it to dessert. Margaret would get booted for throwing food or silverware or for yelling. Then she'd make a grand exit, sometimes laughing and sometimes kicking and screaming, or maybe singing. Sometimes she'd even manage to be kicking and screaming while singing and laughing all at the same time. It wasn't all bad. If every head in the restaurant was still turned toward the door my sister had just been dragged through, nobody noticed if I was quietly digging into my Spumoni ice cream, which I wasn't supposed to eat because I hadn't finished my dinner. We never had to wait long for the check either. I learned what regular dining was like when I worked in restaurants as a teenager. The process of entering a restaurant, being seated, ordering, and eating was accompanied by quiet conversation and laughter. I observed that this series of events could take anywhere from 1 to 2 hours, and that people often seem relaxed during the entire course of things. It was a joyful experience, a series of pleasant events linked together with harmonious transitions involving small talk, sugar, and salt. As we grew up, Margaret's tolerance for public dining improved, but she remained predictably unpredictable. And while we might enjoy the kind of amnesia that comes with time and distance, momentarily forgetting how things used to be, it never took a full minute for us to remember just how bad things could get. Like the evening my parents took us to the little German cafe when we were all in our 20s. There were hardly any other diners there that night, and I'd like to think that's why the place ended up closing down, not because of what happened while we were there. We sat at a long table along one wall, enjoying the atmosphere, chatting and catching up like a normal family. The boys and I had been away at college, and Margaret was living in a group home near my parents' house. We talked and laughed, none of us realizing that Margaret was simmering away at a low boil. Normally, she'd clue us into her mood with a minor episode before anything terrible happened. She'd get irritable or maybe stomp her feet or throw something before we left the house, just to let us know she was feeling impatient. This time, however, we were not so lucky. We weren't prepared when she erupted, throwing her linen napkin high in the air and emitting a mind-blowing screech, the kind that should have shattered the crystal. It only lasted for a second, but it seemed to stop time altogether. I'd been telling some story, and the sound of Margaret's scream just knocked the breath out of me. I felt a slick layer of sweat spring to the surface of my entire body, my scalp, my face, my palms, even the soles of my feet. Across the table, the stunned faces of my brothers hung suspended above the tablecloth. At that exact moment, a nicely dressed, middle-aged woman had the great misfortune to pass our table. She clutched the back of a chair with one hand. The other hand went to her heart. She gave a little cry, and her legs started to buckle. The owner of the restaurant hurried over and helped her back to her own table. Then life started up again. My brothers and parents and I all breathed in and laughed a little hysterically, happy that we hadn't all, in fact, just been run over by a train or vaporized in a nuclear holocaust, although that's what it felt like for a second or two. It was just business as usual. My mother patted Margaret's hand and told her it was okay. Margaret, looking shaky, took a big drink of water and said, "Okay, that's good manners, Mom." Nobody knew what had set her off, just as none of us knew what had calmed her down. All we knew was that we didn't, and we couldn't know, but we felt like we should know so that we could keep it from happening in the first place. My brother Larry can still duplicate the noise she made that night, and although I'll beg him not to, he'll do it every now and then. And then we all laugh and cringe, and I feel like I might cry or throw up, and then we laugh some more. When we were growing up in Spokane, having a relationship with Margaret often felt like living the Bill Murray movie Groundhog Day, but without the resolution. The same kinds of things happened over and over again, and we never seemed to get anywhere. These were the questions that weighed heavily on me when I thought about spending time with my sister. What will she do? How will it make me feel? How will it make her feel? We were family because we were born to the same parents. We were closer to each other genetically than to any other people. But what did that mean exactly? What was she to me, this person who didn't really have much to say, who barely seemed to tolerate my presence one moment and then turned her bright smile on me the next? And what was I to her? Autism had made it impossible for us to communicate about any of this. We human beings rely on stories to explain and order our lives. The core of each story remains the same, though we add and subtract layers depending on the audience, the weather, the balance of happiness and sadness on a given day. Margaret's stories remain locked away inside her mind and heart. She tried to explain herself, but she often did not have access to the words, which frustrated her as much as it frustrated the people around her. She tried to learn some things by rote to give us some satisfaction when we asked, but she often said these things at random, as if searching for what we wanted to hear. What could I do about any or all of this? These questions had been much easier to grapple with when I lived 1,600 miles away in New Mexico. The distance between us meant I didn't have to do anything. I could just ruminate about Margaret, her autism and everything that came with it. The guilt, the hilarity, the stress, and the plain bewilderment that had never seemed to diminish over the course of more than 30 years. But now, I decided to move closer to home. So what had been a two-leg airplane trip would soon shrink to an alarmingly short 5-hour drive. The move would do away with all the easy excuses that I'd never realized I relied on so much. Excuses like, oh, it's so far, or I don't have the money to fly, or I wish I had more time off. The truth of the matter is that living so far away had provided me a safe haven from the demands of my family and that nagging question that had been with me since birth. Just what are you going to do about Margaret anyway? As I sat there staring at Margaret's front porch, I tried to tell myself I wasn't going to figure it all out at once. That was the idea behind the lunch date, starting with something easy. People often say that if you break down a problem into its parts and deal with one part at a time, what seems impossible is actually easy. But then again, people who talk in cliches are apt to bring up those four blind guys who describe an elephant four different ways, depending on which part each has in his hands. That was a worrisome metaphor, as it made me fear I would never understand this family puzzle until it was too late. And as far as I could tell, an elephant was an elephant no matter which part you were holding on to. The elephant in our family room had never seemed bigger than how it looked from where I was sitting in my mother's car. But I realized that I couldn't keep on living with this large animal, and I was tired of stepping around it. I felt like something had to give. I didn't know precisely what to do, but was smart enough to realize that what I had been doing for the past few years hadn't worked. Before I made this trip, I'd known I wanted to see Margaret, but I couldn't face another family gathering with the firebomb of my sister's autism igniting the pages of the family history again. I thought anything had to be better than that. So I took a deep breath, picked up the phone, and called Margaret to ask if she wanted to go out for lunch with me, alone. After a few seconds of mutual anxiety-ridden silence, she mumbled yes and hung up on me. Standing there with the phone in my hand, listening to the dial tone, I had let my thoughts run through the minefield of things that might go wrong during a lunch date with Margaret. I thought it all through. I surrendered myself to whatever might happen and wrote it down on my calendar. Pick up Margaret for lunch, 11:45 a.m. Friday. And then I went to the liquor cabinet and poured myself a stiff drink. I grew up alongside my sister's eccentricities, never really noticing how strange she could be because I'd never known anything else. Just as I always knew to jump in the air to avoid being shocked by the shorted out refrigerator at the lake house and to move the cat out of the fruit basket before putting the bananas in, I always knew that with Margaret along, we were likely to be the center of attention at any public event, and not in a good way. When Margaret misbehaved, everyone would stare. And I always thought they were looking at me, too. Sometimes the faces were just curious. Sometimes they were angry or afraid. After a while, I felt like people were staring, even when they weren't. As we grew older and I passed her developmentally, I began to feel responsible for the staring. It was confusing, at best, to be learning life's rules and social graces alongside someone who had consistently violated every one of them. We wandered through an etiquette desert without a guide. We needed an Emily Post of autism to lead us through the rough patches, but when she didn't show up, we forged ahead anyway. My siblings and I remain, as adults, a self-guided lot, still figuring things out as we go. I often feel like this about my life, mapless, guideless, as if I'm actually hammering the nails into the wood of the bridge I need to walk across, one crappy ramshackle board at a time. I always feel like I'm showing up just a bit unprepared in life, like everyone else got the memo or took the class while I was busy looking for some place to park or finding the bathroom. I thought about that now as I sat outside Margaret's house, trying to work up enough surrender to get out of the car and knock on the door. Sitting in the car, I reminded myself that lunch was a fairly safe option. Everybody has to eat, right? So I sent a prayer to the universe to help everything be okay. I prayed for optimism and grace. I wished I could have a drink, but it wasn't even noon. Instead, I opened the door and got out of the car. Eating in fast food restaurants seldom requires more than everyday good manners. On dining out, Emily Post's etiquette. As an adult with severe autism, my sister has had her share of struggles, Thankfully, I recalled as I stood next to the car, housing is no longer one of them. Margaret lives in an old craftsman-style house near Gonzaga University in Spokane. My parents bought and renovated the house when it became clear that the crappy public housing apartments available to Margaret weren't going to cut it. She kept getting kicked out. Too noisy, the landlords would always say. Well, duh, I always thought. Anyone who has ever lived in one of those shaky 1970s-era cardboard constructions will tell you you can hear someone opening a box of Kleenex three doors down. So imagine what might happen if you lived next door to someone who weighed 180 pounds and was in the habit of throwing herself against the walls and floor during occasional periods of frustration. Too noisy. So Margaret's house became a group home for adults with disabilities expressly because the landlords, my parents, would never kick Margaret out. It has been home to Margaret and her three housemates for many years. A 24-hour staff supports the four of them in living as independently as they can. I painted the house one summer right before Margaret moved in, and I loved every corner. It's the kind of house everyone should have, a big porch and a nice yard, lots of windows to let in the sunshine. The neighborhood sidewalks end in rounded curbs, and the streets, wide enough to drive a circus through, are lined with lovely old trees. From where I was standing at the curb now, I could see groups of college students heading to campus in their cargo shorts and backpacks. On the way there, I'd driven past a herd of toddlers being shepherded along by a couple of middle-aged women. The air was full of chattering little voices and a rainbow of t-shirts as bright as the summer flowers. It made me happy to see the neighborhoodiness of Margaret's neighborhood, especially when I remembered that some of the neighbors in the other nice big houses initially weren't too keen on the idea of having a group home in their midst. I looked at Margaret's front door, knowing I was right on time. Punctuality is a family affliction. We are the people who are 8.5 minutes early when the rest of America is running 15 minutes late. I also knew that Margaret had probably been waiting restlessly for hours, possibly because she was excited to see me, but mostly because she was just anxious. We are indeed an anxious people. We like to stick to the schedule, get on with the show. Margaret's disorder seems to amplify that characteristic. From the curb, I could see her standing at the picture window in the living room, watching me. Even so, she actually let me come up the walkway instead of running out the door, pulling her coat on. She let me climb the stairs and knock on the door like a normal person, which was fun for me. Normally, she might just charge out the door when she saw the car coming down the street, and I'd miss out on practicing the normalcy of it all, the walkway, the knock, the door, the greeting, the introductions and small talk, the leave-taking. Even now, as an adult, I love the distinct phases of events that I had missed out on in my childhood, the almost invisible transitions in social situations. I even loved the moments of awkwardness when nobody knew what to do next. I had spent so many years under the steamroller of autism that these bumps and breaks still held a great deal of appeal for me. These adult days followed a childhood during which greetings and partings meant chasing my mother, who was chasing my sister, who was running through a crowd at some church or school function, and I would wave hello or goodbye at people who gaped at us as we sprinted past. Now, when I knocked, Margaret yanked the door open. "Hi, Eileen," she said, waving at me from just 2 feet away and holding the door open. It was almost like we were regular people. Uninvited, because Margaret wouldn't think to invite someone in, I stepped across the threshold to greet my sister. Here is Margaret, in my arms, the real person. She allowed me a brief hug and then scurried off to get her things. I turned to greet the staff member who'd come in from the living room. Two of Margaret's housemates crowded into the foyer to see who was at the door, and I said hello to them, too. Sarah is a resident busybody at the house. My parents tell me that she makes it her job to keep tabs on Margaret, Ken, Gerald, and the staff. Their comings and goings, as well as their smallest tragedies and victories. It's nearly impossible to keep a secret when Sarah is around, as she is so diligent in her information gathering. "Where are you going?" she now demanded of me, and I began to understand where she got her reputation. I told her we were going out to lunch. In exchange for this piece of information, she offered me some from her own stash. Margaret had gone to my parents' house a few days earlier. Then my mother brought Margaret home, and her boots were in the closet, too. She told me all of this rapidly and ended with a satisfied nod. Ken didn't say anything. He just fluttered his hand at me when I asked him how he was doing and grimaced in an attempt to smile. During this exchange of niceties, Margaret was a tempest of activity. She grabbed her fanny pack off the table by the door, heaved it around her hips, and clipped the clasp shut. Then she rushed over to Sarah, who bowed her head so that Margaret could smell her hair, an old habit of my sister's. Margaret gave a big sniff, yelled, "Bye, Sarah," and trotted out the door and down the wooden steps of the big blue house, ignoring everyone else. I'd forgotten how fast she could move, so I was doing double time trying to keep up as I called goodbye to the rest of them over my shoulder and followed her out to the car. So much for transitions. So much for leaving behind greetings and partings while running.
You've been listening to How to Be a Sister, a love story with a twist of autism by Eileen Garvin, published in 2010 by the Experiment Publishing of New York and read by the author. You can get more information on the author and the book on Google, Eileen Garvin, G-A-R-V-I-N. The Bookshelf is a production of Spokane Public Radio. Executive producer is Vern Windham. Thanks to our two fine technical editors, Ellie Hawkett and Caitlin Webster. They're from the Lewis and Clark PICI class. I'm producer Nancy Roth.